Okay. Now, I would like to introduce our first speaker, who goes by the name of Sarah L. from the Step-by-Step Group of Narcotics Anonymous in the West Side, Baltimore, Maryland area.
Oh. No, that's okay.
Hi, I'm Sarah, and I'm an addict.
Hi, Sarah.
It is definitely an honor to be here, so thank you for inviting me, Programming Committee. Earlier today, we were kind of, a group of us were reminiscing, and my first Unity retreat was in 2001. And I actually was only here for, I got here late Saturday night, so I was really only here for the Sunday speaker, and I was really new in recovery. So I don't remember much other than that, but the symbol and what the t-shirts looked like and the people that were here. But and I've made it back pretty much every year except for the year that I got married. So I think I'm kind of allowed that excuse. We got married right around this time, and with getting ready and vacation time, it just couldn't work out. But this will always be home to me. Coming back here and being able to speak to you guys is amazing because this is where I got clean. These are the people that I hold dearest to me, that saw me and loved me when no one else, I wouldn't have expected anyone else to love me. I felt I was unlovable and just had very low self-esteem. I was pretty crazy. People will tell you that when I came in. We met Crazy Joe last night speaking, and I was kind of thinking maybe people called me Crazy Sarah. I'm not really sure. I know that people talked about me having more issues than Sports Illustrated, but I grew up in this process, and part of that was around that, triangle of self-obsession. What I love about NA is we live in the solution in this program, and that was something that I learned to do here, because so often I was trying to think about the whys, and I was very self-absorbed and intellectual and why does this happen and why did that happen and why am I who I am, and it doesn't matter. It just doesn't. Today I try to live in the solution. So in the triangle of self-obsession, we talk about resentment, anger, and fear, and the solution to that being acceptance, love, and faith. So when I got here, one of the first IPs that actually my sponsor had me read was the self-acceptance pamphlet, because as I mentioned, I had very little self-acceptance. And that has been a process over my entire recovery. I relapsed 2.5 years into the program and quickly came back, thank goodness. But it was definitely harder that second time. So my clean date is actually February 24th, 2004. And from that 2001 to now has been a journey of being okay with me and being okay in the moment. And then working on those other two parts of the triangle of self-obsession. Because I really had to learn how to be okay with me first. Before I could even look at how I was okay with anyone else. I was, earlier I was at a meeting or a workshop with steps 8 and 9, and it talks about, forgiving ourselves is necessary for us to forgive others. And so there was a lot in my life that I was just really angry about, but I didn't look at it as anger. I was a very depressed person. And actually my depression came before my addiction, and my addiction was a symptom of that and a symptom of the chaos in my head and my thinking. And I actually didn't come here via rehabs. I came here via psych wards. I had tried to kill myself, and it was unsuccessful, obviously. I'm standing here, I'm not a ghost, so we're good with that. I had a really smart psychiatrist at that time who was basically, he called me in the one day and just said, if you don't quit using, if you don't quit the drugs, I'm going to send you to rehab. And you're going to get clean because this is a big part of why you're struggling to not want to kill yourself is due to the drugs and like the chaos and the destruction I was causing with drug use. And so I started like this outpatient program and you know, came into the rooms in that summer of 2001 and thought like, yeah, I'm going to stay clean for the summer and I'm going to learn how to use successfully when I go back to college in the fall and we'll be fine. You know, I had all these friends in college or so-called friends that easily forgot about me when I wasn't going to the parties with them and I wasn't hanging out with them all the time. They did like to steal my food in the middle of the night when they were high, but that was about it. Because I was still living in the dorms at the time when I started sophomore year. But there's a lot of stuff in those first couple years of me being in recovery that I am actually more ashamed of than the things that I did when I was using. Because I didn't have an excuse. I didn't have the excuse of, oh, I was drunk, I was blacked out, I was high. It was me. Uh-huh. And that was hard. And it ultimately culminated in me using. And when I came back from that relapse, I had to make a commitment to myself and a commitment to this program and a commitment to this way of life, you know, because up until then, like I came in here before I was 20, I guess. I had never drank in a bar legally. I thought maybe I could outgrow this. I thought that maybe this was just part of growing up for me. You know, I knew people that I abused with that were supposedly living life successfully, or at least what I thought was successfully, while using. But when I relapsed, I learned that that's not me. And I don't really need to look at other people. What I need to know is about myself and what I am capable of doing and able to do. And I came back from that relapse knowing for sure that I am an addict. And so I don't think relapse is a necessary part of anyone's story, but it became a necessary part of mine because it helped me with that self-acceptance piece a little bit more. You know, I had gained a little bit of self-acceptance whenever I was going through the steps before I relapsed. And as soon as I used, it was all gone. Like, I remember looking in the mirror that morning and absolutely fucking hating myself and hating who I looked at. I was smart enough to go to my sponsors that morning and, you know, tell her what happened and what was going on. But like most things in my using, when I relapsed, I destroyed some things. I destroyed some relationships in my life. And for a little bit when I relapsed, I think I was looking back at that resentment piece and I wanted to blame my father. My father left before I was even born. And I think that was probably one of the biggest resentments of my life until I came to a certain level of peace with it. And now we have a really good relationship. I felt abandoned. I felt abandoned before I'd even come out of the womb. And I also was scared because the reason that my parents separated is because my dad cheated on my mom. And when I relapsed, I proved myself to be that cheater as well. And I cheated on a relationship that I had been in for a little while and, you know, meant a lot to me. And part of it was not believing that I deserved anything good in this world because of the self-acceptance and anger and hatred of self. And part of it was not being, you know, committed to the program. And I figure, why not, if I'm going to fuck up royally? You know, let's explode the entire atmosphere instead of, like, dealing with what's going on in life. Which obviously was not the answer. And I know that. And I think the work that I did after that really helped me come to terms with that resentment. You know, I know now, like, my father and mother did the best they could in the moment that they had. Like, those tools that they had, they were doing what they could with them. They were doing the best they had. Who am I to judge them? Because I have no idea what was going on in that relationship at that time. And of course, I'm just as capable as anyone else, obviously, in, you know, in using, in cheating, in lying, in stealing. I have all of those character defects. And what I was realizing, actually, as I was sitting here thinking about this is, one, every time I think before I speak, I never actually speak on whatever I'm thinking about. But I was actually thinking that there's so many, like, in recovery, there's all these aha moments, and there's these moments where we're like, wow, like, I get that. Or even if we don't necessarily, like, we know something's profound, so we at least, like, tuck it away. And I was blessed to have some really good sponsor relationships early in recovery. And they had a lot of things that they gave me that really helped me. And, you know, I was sitting there and I was like, damn, like, there's so much that they taught me. Because around fear, I had led my life in a lot of fear. Fear that I wasn't good enough, that I didn't deserve a good life or a good relationship or what have you. Fear that people were going to walk away from me, so why shouldn't I walk away before they walk away? Fear that I couldn't make it through the day or that I couldn't get to tomorrow. I was very, very fear-based. And at the time, like, one of my sponsors had given me, the sponsor I had at that time, gave me this book called Love is Letting Go of Fear. And, you know, I think back on that and, like, it seems profound at the time when I was reading it and I was thinking about this, like, love and, you know, self-acceptance and loving other people and trust. And as it, you know, says, the solution is faith. But I was still struggling with all of those concepts. Faith was something that I've struggled with since I came into the rooms. And when people first mentioned God, I, like, wanted to run out of the room screaming because my relationship with God was not a good relationship. And it was a relationship of resentment and anger and hatred and not really wanting to think that there's something there, because I really related to what the guy said last night. Like, if there's someone there, they're fucking messed up. Because if they could allow all this stuff on this earth just so we get somewhere else, and that was the faith that I was believed in or raised in, it just didn't make sense to me. And when I was sitting here, I was thinking, so when I was in high school, I went to this Christian camp, kind of like this, only, you know, kind of bigger, and they had programs, and we did these trust falls. And I don't know if any of you guys have ever done trust falls, but I hate trust falls. Because I don't, once again, I don't fucking trust you. That's, like, what it pretty much amounts to. And I don't even trust myself to fall back and let you catch me. And the whole lesson in that was supposed to be, so see how much you trust the person next to you, that's how much you should trust God. And so what I learned from that lesson was, I don't trust you, I don't trust God. And this process, and what recovery has taught me, is that people will fail me always, and God will never fail me. Because my concept of God wasn't big enough until I got into the rooms, and my concept of a higher power wasn't big enough. It wasn't all-encompassing, and it didn't really take in everything that's possible without putting definitions. And for me, that was something else I learned about myself, is I'm so analytical and so, like, I want to intellectualize everything, that when I stopped thinking so hard and I started just doing and I started having faith, no matter if it had a name, it didn't really matter. I just would have faith that if I did the next right thing, if I had good orderly direction, that things would work out okay. They may not be, might not be a millionaire. I might not have like fancy cars and be this actress or a great writer, but things would be better than I expected and better than I had anticipated when I was using, because when I was using, I really thought that I thought I might go great places, but I thought I was going to use for the rest of my life, and I certainly thought I was going to be dead by 30. I was sure of that, you know. And being in recovery when I turned 30, like, that was actually a really big deal for me. Like, I went out and got a tattoo to commemorate turning 30 because I really hadn't expected to make it that far in life. That's how much I didn't want to live life, and I was afraid of life. Because that's what so much of it amounted to, is that I had no control and I had no, like, faith that things would turn out okay. And this program has really given me that, which is just something that's, you know, phenomenal and amazing and has been a process, you know. And thinking back on the retreats that I had been to here, I remember, like, the second year, my second retreat, I was actually the merchandise chair, which was kind of interesting. And I remember, you know, meeting my future husband for the first time. I remember some other, you know, exciting little things. But I also remember it being one of the biggest, like, other than the time when I relapsed, which was probably the worst part of my life, but a growing part. I was going through a lot of stuff. I'd just broken up. I had just gotten out of what was a long-term relationship for me, and I didn't really do relationships. I did one-night stands or friends with benefits, but I didn't really do relationships very well. And it was like a six-month long-distance relationship, which, I don't know. We were both new in recovery. He relapsed while we were dating, and I was really struggling with that. And he was a big, he was also a big part of, like, the circle around me of people I hung out with. And this is really when probably the most of my acting out really happened, before the relapse was around that time. And so not only was I dealing with this, like, having to see this guy that, like, I thought that I loved and, like, I thought was a good relationship, like, that crumbled. But my grandmother had a stroke, and she was in the hospital, like, while the retreat was going on, you know. Like, she had a stroke the week before. And I just remember someone coming up to me and giving me a hug and being like, "It's going to be okay." And I was like, "What do you fucking mean it's going to be okay? Like, my mom's going to die next? Because right now it's not okay." And, like, I remember that every time I, like, am talking to someone who's going through that depth of pain and who's going through those trials in life, because I can relate. I can empathize with that. I totally get being in such despair with your life that you can't imagine things getting any better. And you're, like, thinking, like, really? Like, what can happen next? But for me, what the hope is that I got through that. Like, it happened, and I grew, and when I became more committed to the program, like, you know what? Like, I was clean and helped my grandma through that stroke, and she actually died a few years ago, and she saw me clean, you know? Like, that is in itself is amazing, because my mom one time told me that I was going to give her a heart attack with my using and my craziness. And I didn't. And, like, we had, you know, I was there to support my mom and to, like, be there for her, and let those resentments that I had growing up just kind of fall by the wayside so I could actually live in the moment with her. And I feel, like, it's just so crazy sometimes for me to think about what I was like then. And, you know, I tell people, like, I was such a bitch. And I'm not that anymore, which I'm, like, incredibly grateful for. And humbled at the same time that, like, I could go from something that was so, in my mind, tarnished to something that my mom calls me, you know, her rock. And I've been able to, like, hold her hand when she went through breast cancer treatment. And I've been able to be there for her. And I've been able to be there for my sister and my family and other people and people in recovery when it's like all of those paying back for all the people that still gave me a hug when I walked in after relapsing and still loved me until I could love myself. I've you know, made a couple moves in recovery, actually moved to a new area like 10 years ago. And, you know, my husband and I had moved there together and we weren't married yet. You know, he was going to do grad school and I was just going to ride his coattails because I was done with college and didn't know what I wanted to do so I could find a job there, which was better than finding a job in Patton, Pennsylvania, if anyone knows where that is. And it's so much harder to, like, go into a new area and to, like, be who you were when you came in and to build those relationships. Because when I came in, like I said, I was so vulnerable. I was so broken. And I continued to break myself over and over and over. And people saw me at my absolute worst and continued to love me. And when you go to a new area, they look at you and they're like, oh, you got your shit together. You know what you're doing. You got a job. You can pay your bills. You can afford to buy a car. Like, all of these things that you get when you do stay clean. And they don't see, like, that broken person. I mean, they can relate. Like, don't get me wrong. We all know what addicts are like. And we all know what we're capable of. And so I'm sure they can look at me and be like, well, she's definitely capable of that. But it wasn't quite the same, and I felt like for the time that we were there that I was just kind of like hanging out on the sidelines of recovery in a lot of ways, and like not, you know, I picked a sponsor in name only. I had a home group that I went to on a consistent basis. You know, I went every week to Thursday nights, and but I was really actually happy to move. Because I never found, like, it wasn't like finding the group that I got clean with, and it's so different when you do move. So we made another move to actually Baltimore, which is where I am now. And the first year that we were there was like kind of a little bit of a struggle in getting connected. You know, we met someone from State College. So that was good. As soon as you meet someone who's like from your area that moved down there, then you kind of feel like, okay, at least we have this person that we can be connected to. And probably just in the past, like, half year, I felt like I was starting to make those connections. And they might not be as deep as, like, the connections that I originally made in recovery here that I come back to every year. But they're deep in the sense of I know that these people want me around. And they don't want me around as, like, people when I use. They don't want me around for what I have. As far as like material stuff or drugs or whatever, they want me around because they enjoy my company and that I'm another recovering addict and I'm trying to do the next right thing. And that has given me a lot of like, has even further deepened that safe in a sense. Because those 8 years that we were in Harrisburg, I remember praying on a consistent basis that God would put somebody, a friend or sponsor or what have you in my life that I could connect to, that I could feel like joy about my local area of recovery and not feel like my big shot of hope was coming here every year. And it may have taken those 8 years, but that stuff's coming to fruition. And the things that I have wanted are coming, are happening. When I was in that that second year that I was here, and I was in that, had just gotten out of that relationship, and my sponsor told me that I should, the people that I was having resentments against, that I should pray they get everything they want and need. And part of me was like, okay, I could do that because usually everything we want isn't everything that we need. And so if they get everything they want, this could be really bad for them. And it could be like karma. Even though I was probably the bad one and needed the karma. And so it started off being this prayer of like, kind of sarcasm and give them everything they want and need. And over time, it became a prayer of actual like meaning and you know, really wanting the people in my life that I had resentments against to have their best. Because in all reality, I don't want anyone to go through any pain. And I shared this at a meeting recently, like one of my other long-term prayers has always been like that I have a moment of peace and that someone else has a moment of peace. And that prayer kind of melted into the one about everyone getting what they want and need, because in reality, like, I want everyone to have, like, exactly what I want for myself and nothing less. You know, I want them to have joy and I want them to have peace. And because I've been able to, like, work on that triangle of self-obsession, I've been able to, like, find that peace. I've been able to find my self-acceptance and I've been able to find my faith. And I've been able to find, you know, love. And I don't have drama in my life, which sometimes I like listen to other people talk about drama and I'm like, huh, life seems slightly dull. But in all reality, like, I am really happy with a dull life, which I never thought I would be before I got clean. And it's really not that dull. By dull, I mean that things actually happen when they're supposed to happen, like bills get paid. You know, we do the adult things like buying a house instead of, you know, throwing our money away on the really high rent of Baltimore. You know, we do like the things we need to do to like have that drama-free and peaceful life. Don't get me wrong, I know that drama could enter at any second, but that's also part of why I want to keep coming back, because as soon as my mind starts going through chaos, that's when I know that like it's been too long without a meeting or it's been too long without talking to an addict. Because for me, obviously, like we always say, it's always about the drugs, but it's also not about the drugs, because it's about my thinking. My thinking made me use. I feel very, very blessed to be here tonight. I love fire meetings because nobody can see me and I can't see anyone else. So that's awesome. sometimes we share things we didn't mean to share when there's a fire and nobody can really see us. So I hope that somebody was able to get something, and I really hope that each of you find that peaceful moment for yourself.
Hey, I'm really sorry for the frat noise back there, but it got a little loud there. I almost yelled something. I didn't want to. That's just the way it goes, I suppose. I would like to introduce the second speaker, which is a good friend of mine, as Sarah was, and has been around for, well, ever. I give you David G., Just for Today Group of N.A. from Butler. Yay!
Oh, yeah. Oh. Right. I got mine if I need one.
Okay, thank you.
Hey, everybody. I'm an addict named David.
David.
Hi. So I wanted to, you know, I was having a resentment going because those guys were having fun without me. And, you know, I had the blessing of forgetfulness when I got the call to share on this topic probably like a month and a half ago. And, you know, I said yes, and then a day later, I told somebody I got this call, and I couldn't remember what the topic was, and that was a good thing. So, you know, I was talking to one of the members of the committee last week, and I said, "What's my topic again?" And she told me. I said, "Oh, geez, that's a great one." I joked that this thing was written for me, but you guys can read it too. But it's uncanny the way our literature is written in a way that that it applies to each one of us in our in its way for us. And you know, my experience of this has changed over time, but I read it today and it blew me away. Every line, you know, I thought, all I really need to do is to read this thing and sit down, because it says what my experience has taught me about the triangle of self-obsession. But of course that would mean you wouldn't hear me talk for the next however long, so I have to do something different. How this works in my life. You know, I was looking at resentment, anger, and fear, the triangle of self-obsession, and thinking back to the fact that those three things have run my life from my earliest memories. You know, as a child, when it was time to go to first grade, I was scared to death. I cried. I was convinced that I wasn't going to succeed at first grade, that I was going to get there, and nobody was going to like me. I had all sorts of irrational fears, and you know, my parents tried to calm me down and said, "Just go. You'll be okay." And I went, and it was okay. You know, the first day I actually enjoyed. You know, my worst fears hardly ever come true. But that doesn't keep me from having my worst fears at any given time. That kind of thinking has continued throughout my life. You know, I really appreciate the stuff that Sarah was sharing, and I am, you know, I'm really inspired when I hear people get clean in their 20s or in their 30s. I managed to use for about 30 years before I finally got a clean date that I could hold on to. And I just turned 56, and you know, I've come to terms with the fact that there's more of my life behind me than there is ahead of me, probably. But I'm also grateful that I've had a chance to work this program and develop a closer contact with who I am, with a power greater than me, and with the hope and the faith that there are still a lot of great things ahead in my life for me before I make my exit. And I say that because on any given day, I can be locked in the triangle of self-obsession. We say that obsession is the core of our disease. That, you know, self-centeredness is the core of our disease. And for me, resentment, anger, and fear are truly my go-to ways of initially reacting to any situation. My gut reaction is to be pissed off and to be afraid of what might happen. And through working some steps and through coming here and getting some time behind me, I've been able to come to peace with that initial reaction and realize that doesn't have to be my final answer in any given situation. You know, so the fear for me right now is a feeling of inadequacy to share at this podium. I was at a meeting just before now, and it was on steps 10 and 11, and listening to the two people who shared, I was humbled by their level of spiritual growth that they've achieved through the program. And my initial reaction is anger at myself, resentment at myself, because I don't feel like I've put that much work into my program. I've managed to stay clean all this time, and yet I don't, my initial response to experiencing someone else's recovery, seeing them from outside of them, is thinking that they've got it going on and I don't. And intellectually, I know that's not true, because I know that my experience of life is that I can be much more loving and caring and accepting and forgiving and compassionate and empathetic now than I could be 10 years ago. But, you know, there's that perfectionist element of my personality that thinks that I need to do that better. I need to be more available. The one time I don't answer the phone for a sponsee definitely trumps the five times that I do. And it's real easy for me to get locked into that beating myself up part and then to react to that resentment of myself and of my imperfections by then overcompensating and, you know, feeling some sort of ego gratification from, you know, being an active member of Narcotics Anonymous and being out there in the program and so on. You know, I do service and earlier in service, and as I've gone on through different responsibilities and service positions, I've been perceived as having control issues and being, trying to manage things and control things and tell people what to do. And, you know, they were right. I was doing that. And why was I doing that? Because I was fearful and I wasn't having faith in the process, and I wasn't firm in my belief that a higher power has this fellowship, has whatever committee I'm working on, has our best interest at heart. So learning to walk through that fear and learn through mistakes and through experience that faith is justified is one of the gifts of recovery for me. And you know, past becomes future. I'm sitting in that meeting on 10 and 11 and I'm getting all filled up with all of this really great perspective on contact with a loving higher power and how I can be more in touch with how I'm feeling and how I'm behaving on any given day and all this great stuff. And I'm looking at my watch and I'm saying, you people, can't you stop talking, because don't you know that I have to go and speak? And it's getting, you know, and the fear was overcoming my ability to listen and to be present in the moment. And I became aware of that, and I centered myself, and I breathed, and I returned to listening to them. And then that feeling would come up again. And I would have to repeat that process over and over again of being aware of the screwed up thinking that was going on in my head and, you know, recollecting myself and then getting back in the moment. Because in the present moment, if I can be in that place of centeredness, if I can step outside of my own selfish wants and needs, I can be present in love. I can be willing to accept whatever has happened or whatever is happening. I don't have to be pissed off all the time. You know, like 20, 25 years ago, I was involved in a project and I was, you know, talking to somebody in a bar and after a few drinks, and we were talking politics and philosophy, and I thought I was getting really passionate, and they said, "Why are you so pissed off?" And I thought I wasn't pissed off, I was just passionate. But I was coming off, and what I realized, I was coming off as angry because I wanted things to be a certain way, and I wanted them to see it my way, and I was asserting my point of view and not listening to theirs. And as a result, I was unhappy. I was angry. And you know, even take the alcohol out of the equation, I still would have reacted that way because I was locked in needing to be right and needing you to agree with me. And to learn through the process of recovery how to, as it said, how to understand rather than to be understood. How to love instead of just expecting to be loved. These things directed toward helping others and putting my own selfish needs and wants aside are challenging, but the more one practices them, I think, you know, in my experience, the easier it is for me to repeat that behavior. And as a result of acting in a more spiritual way, in a less self-centered way, I feel better. And so I'm kind of like getting what I want without having to be locked in the triangle of self-obsession. It's kind of like by helping others, I feel better about myself. And then I don't have to overcompensate by falling back into that triangle again. You know, and it's funny too, like, you know, everything that we believe is subject to revision, especially what we know about the truth. You know, I was sure when I was thinking about this a couple days ago that that resentments we try to transmute into forgiveness. But no, that's not what it says. It doesn't say forgiveness, it says acceptance. And it's interesting because I try to be compassionate and I try to forgive things that have happened in the past and forgive myself for things that have happened. And what I've found is sometimes I'm not authentic in that forgiveness. Sometimes I really still do have a little bit of that resentment that's carrying on. And I'm lying to myself if I think that it's totally in the past because it can still come back up every once in a while. But what I definitely have achieved is acceptance of things that have happened in the past. I can accept it without having forgiven it. And that also gives me some peace. You know, a dumb example, but, you know, it came up today. There was a guy who was chairing a meeting down here, and he was wearing a Pittsburgh Pirates jersey, number 21, and, you know, Roberto Clemente, and, you know, I shared because I kind of like to play around with the fact that I'm an old man now, and I, you know, say, well, you know, I saw Roberto Clemente play right field in Forbes Field, 1965. And of course, you know, I'm fishing for that, oh, you don't look that old and all that. And thankfully I get it and I feel good about that. But what that also brought up was I went with my dad and my granddad and you know, my granddad disappeared for a while, and it turns out what he did was he went down into the Pirates' dugout, and he passed around a baseball, and all of the Pirates signed that baseball. And then he brought it up and gave it to me. And I had that baseball for years. You know, I took it with me to college. I took it with me back home. You know, it was always under my bed when I was a kid. And then I bought a house and I took it with me to that house, and that was where a lot of my craziest using at the end took place, at that house. And there was a guy who you know, posted up in our house and did what we did. And you know, he did what we do, and that is he did what he needed to do to get the next one, which he sold my baseball. And you know, I was angry and I was resentful, which is totally normal, I think, initially. And you know, and then through doing a little bit of work, I was able to come to understand that, you know, he did what we do. And my part in it was I had the baseball sitting in an open cupboard in a crack house. So, you know, chances are it might get stolen. So, you know, I accept my part. And I accept that he did what he did. And I kind of forgive him for what he did. But I didn't completely forgive him right away. And I pretty much do forgive him now. And every once in a while, the resentment comes back. And I have to just say, hi, resentment. And that's okay. These thoughts come up, and I can recognize them for what they are now. And that's like one of the things that the folks were talking about out there now is that, you know, like step 10 is recognizing what's happening now, recognizing how the stuff that I've dealt with and the steps up to that point are rearing their head today. Am I doing the stuff today that I had thought I had, gotten past yesterday? Is it back? And why? And what can I do about it? So, the triangle of self-obsession, it never really shuts up, but it gets less powerful for me as time goes along. If I look at it now, it's after doing a fourth step and a fifth with my sponsor and then, you know, recognizing and having awareness of the defects and then asking for them to be removed and replaced by more constructive thoughts and behaviors. I don't have to have as many resentments. I don't have to be as angry. I can find acceptance more easily for myself and for others. I can suspend judgment on you because I can let you be you where you're at. I have, especially though, and the last thing that I think is in this for me to share is, you know, that crushing fear that I had early in my life and through my life and that can still show up today is replaced by faith. And, you know, for me, in coming to believe in a power greater than myself and in fully participating in this program, it's been necessary, and I loved what the gentleman just said in the last meeting. He said to come to believe in a power, to turn my will and my life over to the God of my misunderstanding. I'm not really sure what it is all the time, but I know it's not what I thought it was when I was growing up. I know it's not what I was taught, because that God didn't like me, and it wasn't about anything that I believed in, and certainly nothing that I felt. And I, the resentment that I built because of that experience of religion in my childhood carried through many, many, many years into my adulthood. I developed political beliefs, and I developed all sorts of ways of thinking and believing and speaking and acting that were based upon that resentment. And in coming into recovery, I had to get past that resentment. The first resentment I wrote about in my fourth step was about the organized religion that I was raised with. And as a result of writing about that and admitting that to myself and sharing that with my sponsor and looking at that process, I got past the resentment. I got past the fear of of not believing in that, and I came to believe in something that was loving and caring and bigger than me. And in doing that, then I was able to see that at work. My mind opened up and I could see a loving, caring, higher power working among us and in the world at large. I became less cynical. I became softer. I became more accepting of people with differing opinions. You are allowed to disagree with me now, because I have faith through experience. My faith comes to me through experience of seeing my higher power working in my life and in the lives of the people around me and in the world that I live in. So, you know, it's easy to have acceptance when you want to give me $100. It's not so easy to have acceptance if you want $100 from me. But they're both reality, and I do better, I feel better, I live better when I can accept either one, when I can accept what life has to give me on a daily basis, when I can love somebody for being just where they're at, and even if they annoy me a little bit, that I can let that go, that I can accept them for who they are, and then that I have faith that everything is in order. There's good orderly direction going on in this world, and even if I can't see it, that doesn't mean that it doesn't exist. I've learned to have faith because things happen beyond my understanding. There was a speaker today on plan the actions and not the results, and that was very powerful for me. I'm going through a change in my life right now where I want to change careers, you know, I'm doing the actions like the resume and making contacts and networking and all the stuff that they tell you to do, but for me to choose a particular thing and say this is what I want to do is limiting the possibilities. It's like anytime I choose a preferred outcome, I'm selling myself short. And that's my experience, is that things are just so much greater than what I could imagine when I allow them to unfold, and when I don't try to make them happen, I let them happen. I participate in them happening. And for me, that's when I can step out of the triangle of self-obsession and find acceptance, love, and faith in a better future. That's all I have. I'm a addict named David. Thank you.